This is Embodied on the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Is it credible for a corporation that makes billions selling skin bleaching products to people of color to issue a public statement supporting anti-racism? That was one question activists raised in June when Unilever, a company that sells a product called Fair and Lovely, released its statement in support of Black Lives Matter. Unilever wasn't alone. L'Oreal also responded to the death of George Floyd by decrying racism while continuing to sell products that promise consumers whiter skin. While those companies were being called out for apparent hypocrisy, Priya Rao started investigating their history. Just how had they marketed skin lightening creams to darker skin consumers? Priya is the executive editor of the beauty website Glossy and the host of Unfair, Glossy's new podcast series about the global skin lightening industry. Priya, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me about how skin lightening products became a part of the national consciousness this summer in the wake of George Floyd's death. How did they come into the spotlight?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, after what happened with George Floyd and the public outcry for his death and the support for Black Lives Matter, you know, it became apparent that companies had to respond. Companies like Unilever, L'Oreal, across the gamut, they were saying, you know, Black Lives Matter, BIPOC, people of color matter. And yet when they were posting these marketing statements and when they were posting these statements on Instagram or social media, they were quickly called to task because although they were saying this, they were actually actively marketing and selling products that said something otherwise.
And I guess it's important to note that while we may be familiar with the products on the shelves here in the U.S., these U.S.-based companies play a huge role in a worldwide market and sell all kinds of other products. So talk a bit about the role that they play in selling and marketing these products around the world.
Well, see, that's the thing, is that the internet has made everything a lot more connected. And so you can't have products being sold here in the U.S. and then not know what's going on in China or the Philippines or Africa or India. And that's what these products, these companies were doing. You know, you mentioned Fair and Lovely a second ago, which is now Glow and Lovely. That was their rebranding take in response to this public outcry. But that's the biggest beauty brand in India. You think about brands in that are sold in Asia or China, and the biggest products that are sold there are skin lightening cream. So, you know, this is all very holistic. And even though those products may not be mainstream here in the U.S., they have billions of customers around the world.
What did you learn about how many folks are using these products? I mean, I think the statistics are kind of surprising when you begin to dig into it a little bit.
Well, the thing is like, it's not just the stuff that is being sold on, you know, a regular grocery shelf or online. It's also the black market of these products and what these products are able to do. And so even here in the U.S., although you may not think that like skin lightening is the demand for skin lightening is huge here, what we found out was that, you know, even up until last year, Amazon was selling products here in the U.S. with mercury in them. And mercury is one of the biggest like culprits of skin lightening around the world, probably the most dangerous. But, That change only happened last fall, and they're still selling products online with hydroquinone in excess of 2%, which is illegal here in the U.S. And so there is a demand here in the U.S. too. And it's like what we found is that it's in large immigrant populations, you know, whether it's in Minnesota or California or Texas or New York. And it's being done online. It's being done in local markets. It's kind of what one dermatologist told me was a pandemic.
Hmm. So we're going to get more into the health risks and the medical aspects of mercury and hydroquinone and all of these other products a little bit later. But I want to talk now about colorism and obviously how that shapes people's desire to lighten their skin, their perception of how their skin looks. And in your podcast, you talk with a variety of folks from a variety of different ethnic communities looking at how the dynamics of colorism play out differently. So can you talk a bit about that and what you began to uncover about the diversity of kinds of colorism, even just in the U.S.?
Right. Well, I think what's surprising is that I really understood what I didn't understand was that it was a global issue. And this is happening in every community, every ethnicity, every culture. And so what we found is that, you know, so much of it is, you know, abroad, it was related back to casteism, classism, you know, it goes back to, you know, people working in the fields, in farms in Asia, and because they had darker skin, they were using these products to, you know, be lighter, to be considered part of a more European beauty standard. And when you think about that, that goes back to colonialism, because so many of these countries were, invaded and taken over by the British and by European countries. So that's part of it. but also the casteism piece of it. People think that, you know, if they are more well off, if they have more access to wealth and opportunity, then they're not spending as much time indoors. That was something that we actually found here in the U.S. because, you know, one of the surprising twists in the show was that we found out that Madam C.J. Walker's brand, which is an African-American brand here in the U.S., was also selling these products after her death. So that just goes to show that even African-American companies here in the U.S. were charged to sell this because there was a business opportunity here. And the reason why they did that was because when, like, the white population here in the U.S. were able to, you know, when work moved indoors, tanning became a class, a leisure activity. And so it became more attractive to be tan if you were lighter. But then at the same time, darker communities had to be whiter to be considered more wealthy or well off.
Well, this comparison to tanning is really interesting because I think it comes up a lot in conversations where people say, okay, some people may lighten their skin with creams, but hey, I know all of these folks that go into tanning beds. So isn't it more or less the same thing, a desire to kind of change the look of your skin? Are they both kind of the same? Is one more harmful than the other? You look at this a little bit in your podcast. Can you talk about why you think that's kind of a false comparison?
It is a false comparison because if you think about, you know, that the opportunity piece, the wealth, the class piece, is that people are using these products so that they appear more worthy in the size, in the European mindset, in the white mindset. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, in places in India and in Asia and in China and even in Africa, you know, these people think that if they have lighter skin, they can get a job, they can get a husband, they can get, you know, their family out of poverty. So that's one example. And in terms of tanning, you know, the beauty industry has had a long history of a problem solution storyline, in the sense that they are saying, like, hey, here's something wrong with you, let us fix it. But they're not just saying that there's something wrong with you. This is something that someone's born with. This is who they are. And, like, they're trying to say that who you are, who you're born with, is not okay.
You turn the lens on yourself in your podcast and look at how these dynamics show up in the Indian community and in the Indian American community. And in the first episode, you actually interview your mom. So before we play a clip from that, I want to hear a bit about how language around colorism and skin shade has played a role in your own life.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, obviously my parents immigrated here to the United States in the 70s. I was born here. I was the only person in my family to be born in the U.S., the first person. And, you know, my mom is very fair. My father, for his part, is much darker. And, you know, I think there's a lot of euphemisms around this. Although my mom never thought, you know, it was racist or it was, you know, she was promoting colorism. I mean, she did use words like fair and lighter and glow. And those were synonymous terms with, you know, whiter skin. And, you know, I grew up in South Texas on the border of Laredo, on the border of Texas and Mexico, and Laredo, where all I did was go swimming. And, you know, it was like, oh, don't go stay out in the sun so long. You don't want to be get too dark. I remember these are still statements that my mom will say to me today. And I think it's just something that is so ingrained in the culture because everybody is trying to vie to be something they're not.
Let's listen to a conversation with your mom in the first episode of Unfair.
When you are blessed with a beautiful complexion, why do you want to expose it to sun and lose it and become dark? And don't you think it is good to preserve it? See, that is the only notion here. It is not that because I'm thinking you two, because you're fairer, are more beautiful than the other two who are not as fair. But, you know, I put pressure because I wanted you to maintain that color and not lose it.
I'm talking with Priya Rao, the host of the podcast Unfair. That was a clip of her mom. I love that clip because I think it illuminates so much of kind of what I experienced also growing up as an Indian American, watching my friends kind of go to the pool with them and cover their whole bodies underneath a towel because they didn't want to get darker because they would get in trouble when they went home. And it's still, I mean, it's still very, very prevalent today.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, what we heard, one of the people we also interviewed in this podcast was a Filipino girl who lives in the United States. And she was saying that, you know, because of the culture, because of the what was ingrained in her mind and from Filipino TV, you know, she was using skin lightening products even while, you know, she was living outside in the California sun. So, you know, you see this dichotomy of what's expected, but then you're also, you know, you're kind of robbing yourself of, like, the opportunities that other people, kids your age, are living.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. Alicia D. Williams is a teacher in Charlotte and the author of Genesis Begins Again, a young adult novel about colorism. Alicia, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you.
So you've been hearing this conversation and a bit of Priya's personal experience as well as the deep history, and you have your own personal story of how colorism showed up in your life, even at a really early age. So tell us a little bit about your own story.
Yes. Well, I grew up, I was born to a light-skinned mom with this beautiful, gorgeous, fine hair and a dark-skinned father, and it's always pitted on both sides of the family. My light-skinned mom, it was always the comparison on her side of the family. Oh, you look just like your daddy. And it's how they said it, too, with this bite to it. Oh, you have dark lips like him, and your gums are dark, to the point that they're scrutinizing everything from my hair to my even features, because colorism does add a point to the features as well. But and even on my dark skin side, my grandmother would say, you don't want to have a baby by a dark-skinned man because you're going to have dark-skinned babies. So you have this, and growing when a baby is born in our family, and this is, I want to say, this is not just my family, but it's important that they check the cuticles and the tip of the ears, because a baby is born light and it would darken over time. And that is the color they expect the baby to be. And that's how you know what kind of life or what kind of favoritism that they'll get, even within the own family. So this whole idea of being light, you're with the cousins and you at family events. I was never one the fun, the cute one or the pretty one. It was, I had to go on being smart or something else because I was never affirmed in that. And I thought it's not just in my family, but it's in the community as well. So you go to church and you get the old mothers and, oh, you're so cute. And intellect was based off of how light you were. I bet you're just as smart as you want to be. You know, these words were privy to lighter skin. And it's that idea of privilege that comes with it. And if you're in trouble, and you can get as much trouble you want to be if you're light skin, with just might get a smack on the wrist, but the darker you are, that's witches coming out too.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you mentioned education, and there are statistics that, I mean, support that, you know, that folks kind of see people with lighter skin as more educated than those with darker skin, job advantages in the job process, even in the prison system. So obviously real consequences and real life implications. Did you ever have a desire, or did you ever attempt to change the color of your skin through treatments or products or anything like that?
No, I have never, but it felt that need to go that far. But that doesn't say I haven't witnessed others to feel that need. And it's so funny because growing up, we didn't have the language to know what colorism was, but we knew it existed. We knew it existed because of the way adults kind of preferred or gave more on a plate to someone else during dinner time. So we knew it existed, but it's so ingrained in us that we perpetuate it either on our own kids or we internalize it. When I was writing Genesis, the story Genesis Begins Again, I became real aware of things that I thought I buried. And I remember being out with my lighter skinned cousin, and she's very ambiguous depending on the color she wears her hair. And all of her friends were light skinned, and we were coming out the restroom, and you know how I mean, stand around gawking. And I was so sensitive as they were like, oh, she's cute, and got to me, oh, you're the chocolate one of the bunch. Now, I was so keenly aware that, you know, my emotions almost flooded with tears, but that's how I didn't want to change it, but I did get was a recipient. I would date you if you were a shade lighter, or, you know, I would want a baby. Even my brother and cousins, they only dated light-skinned girls with a certain eye color, and that just showed me that I was unlovable, and people like me were unlovable, but I didn't have that need to do it. Go ahead. But we see people doing it without necessarily getting this bleaching, because we do it with our filters.
Yeah, social media.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting because it's a difference between using that kind of cream outright to change, you know, your skin color versus applying a filter so that the way that you appear to everyone on social media is lighter.
Exactly. It's hilarious because when we look on social media, these filters who makes us lighter, and I know people who that's the only filter that they use. And not only that, it's the makeup. I noticed that the makeup that we use is becoming heavy, more heavy and more lighter. And I wonder if it's the influence with technology and social media with celebrities. You can see the course. If you Google skin lightening, they will show you how the lighting or either the makeup or if they are honestly bleaching, how celebrities have gotten lighter over time.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, as adult women, we still have this feeling from brokenness from as a child, but we see this. And this is what we perpetuate. Even you have social media influencers like Blac Chyna, who is the Rob Kardashian's ex, who sells it. So that makes it even more the norm that it's okay to accept it's a part of wearing contacts or it's a part of wearing a weave, just lighting your skin.
Yeah, give me 1 second here. I'm talking with Alicia D. Williams and Priya Rao today on The State of Things. Yeah, I mean, you see it perpetuated everywhere on social media. And I mean, you even see kids picking up on these preferences really, really early, like even in kindergarten. So can you talk to me about how it shows up from such an early age before they maybe have even have the language to talk about their feelings about their skin color?
Yes, I've seen it firsthand in kindergarten. And the school I was working in had diverse crayons. So the skin tone crayons and our brown and black children, it did not matter the background, cultural background. They did not choose the skin tone crayon that matched them. Now, our white children, they would even go so far to choose a brown crayon to draw their parents because they saw them as tanned. But our black and brown children were acutely aware, obviously, because they would not choose their skin tone. By the middle of the school year, we got them to choose the skin tone crayon, but they would shade it in very lightly, while other students were hammering in and pressing hard on the crayon. And by the end of the year, we got them to press in. So I knew that something, they were getting it from somewhere. I don't know if it was family members or what the messages were coming from another place, because it made me think of Dr. Henry Clark's baby doll experiment where he had the light skin and a dark skin baby dolls, and he would ask the 5-year-olds, which is the good doll, which is the bad doll, which is the pretty doll, which is the ugly doll, which doll looks like you? And 9 times out of 10 in this social experiment, brown children would choose the ugly bad doll as the black doll and the beautiful good doll as the blonde hair, blue eyed white doll.
Yeah, so much of it kind of reinforced by everything that we read and what we see. I only have about 30 seconds, but with your book, I mean, what do you hope that students will be able to see that could change how they perceive themselves?
I really hope that they have this conversation early on to identify why they are feeling this way, identify and have the courage to say, I don't accept this way of thinking. This is an old traditional way of thinking, marrying up, lightening the race. I don't subscribe to it. And have the vocabulary and the critical thinking to think why.
Alicia,
I really hope we could banish it.
Alicia D. Williams is a teacher in Charlotte and the author of Genesis Begins Again, a young adult novel about colorism. Thanks so much, Alicia.
Thank you.
Priya Rao is still with us. She's executive editor of Glossy and the host of Unfair, a podcast about the global skin lightening industry. Joining us now is Dr. Kanyezi Ferguson. Dr. Ferguson is a dermatological surgeon and the director of the Ethnic Skin Care Clinic at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Dr. Ferguson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Priya, I want to start with you really quick and hear a bit more of your research into the black market for these creams and why it's so common that these treatments are largely unregulated. What did you find there?
Yeah, it was really surprising, actually, because, you know, it started with the Amazon case that happened last year in Minnesota, where several products were laden with mercury, and Amazon was still selling them from third-party distributors on their platform to people here in the U.S. That recently got changed, but what you found was that other ingredients in excess of their, like, limited or legal quantities, like hydroquinone, were being promoted, being sold on Amazon as well as on Etsy, promoted on platforms like Facebook and Facebook Shopping and Instagram Shops. So what we're finding is that this isn't just what's happening, you know, in local markets or local drugstores in certain communities, but rather this is, you know, happening very widely and broadly in the digital community.
So while hydroquinone is banned in the EU, it can be bought over the counter in the U.S. Up to 2% and also can be prescribed. So, Dr. Ferguson, tell us a bit about hydroquinone as a chemical and what it is and what the proper way to use it would be.
Yes, absolutely. So hydroquinone is a medication that's applied to the skin surface and is used to treat dark spots and patches on the skin that are caused by a number of skin conditions. And it works by decreasing the production of pigment and does this by reducing activity of an important protein or an enzyme and essentially pauses the pigment production of these cells. And so hydroquinone is used for a number of pigmentary disorders where the pigment in the skin essentially is overproducing pigment leading to dark areas. So a common condition called melasma is something that we use this for, where individuals will get dark areas on the cheeks, on the forehead, and on the upper lip are kind of common locations. Other conditions that we'll use this for are what we call post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. So essentially the skin's reaction to, you know, common skin diseases like acne or eczema or anything that causes redness or inflammation on the skin.
Do you see I was just going to ask if you see people using it for reasons other than those medically necessary or medically advised reasons.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, we consider hydroquinone as misused when it's used for long periods of time without supervision of a healthcare provider, such as a board-certified dermatologist, and when it's used for purposes of skin bleaching to lighten normal skin color and not for the purposes of treating these pigmentary disorders.
So you are a dermatologist that created this ethnic skin care clinic because you wanted to acknowledge that skin of color has unique needs and patients of color have unique skin challenges. So talk to me a bit about that and the necessity for this kind of dermatological resource.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there are certain skin diseases that affect skin of color patients at a higher incidence or higher frequency. But also common skin conditions, like I had mentioned, have different reaction patterns on darker skin. So darker skin tends to react to skin diseases differently by causing different reaction patterns on the skin. And also darker skin may react to different types of treatments and different types of procedures or lasers in slightly different ways because of this varying reaction pattern. So not only being aware of these nuanced differences in caring for not only skin, but also hair disorders in this patient population is very important. And for me, being in an academic center to also educate our trainees who will be practicing around the country to really provide dermatologic care in a very culturally competent manner that's relevant for our patients.
I want to know more about kind of the psychological impact of skin challenges. And Priya, I want to start with you because you spoke to folks who were talking with people in a variety of immigrant communities and kind of came to know people who went to took some pretty extreme risks to change the color of their skin because of kind of an embedded psychological, you know, motivation. So can you talk about kind of what you came to understand about the psychology behind the impetus to do this?
Yeah, I think it is, going back to what we talked about earlier, it is this desire to be, you know, something that they're not because they feel like the opportunities they're being given are not the same or equal to others. And there is this European standard that if, you know, you were fairer, if you were whiter, that you would be able to, you know, marry easier, be well thought of in your family, have a better paying job. You know, I think one of the craziest things was that when we were talking to the Minnesota Public Department of Health, they were telling us a story of, you know, many people didn't even realize what they were doing to themselves. You know, one family actually created like a super spreader event where they were using illegal skin lightening creams that were laden with like harmful ingredients. And their laundry machine, because it had gotten in the air, it had gotten in the clothes, and it was just spreading throughout their family. And they didn't realize the gravity of the situation. But when someone came in with like basically a Ghostbusters-like tool to measure, you know, what they were consuming, it was off the charts. You know, and so people don't really understand the harmful effects. Like they may be understanding that, oh, this is a quick fix to get a little bit of lighter skin for a short amount of time period. But I don't think they really understand that the long-term health effects are so grave. You know, there was someone in California that we spoke to that was still in a coma from last year from using these kind of products.
Dr. Ferguson, talk about navigating that within the context of your practice. You know, if someone were to kind of come to see you and talk about an issue with their pigmentation, how do you navigate kind of the psychological impact of the skin challenge with what is medically necessary and have those conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in dermatology, and especially in my clinic, I think really understanding that skin disease, you know, affects more than an individual's appearance and really can take a toll on one's emotional health, as that can affect self-esteem and self-image and quality of life as well. And so when I evaluate patients, really, I think managing expectations and also understanding, you know, kind of their underlying skin conditions and actually what the causes of some of these pigmentary changes that individuals may see on the skin. And it's very important because, you know, a lot of what I'm seeing in clinic are a reaction pattern to an underlying disease. And so it's so important to treat that underlying disease, you know, to prevent some of these pigmentary, you know, changes in the first place. And I think also understanding the impact that sun exposure also plays in, you know, kind of increasing, you know, pigment production and making some of these pigmentary issues worse. So going into a lot of detail then about the importance of, you know, sun protection, using sunscreen, sun avoidance, and protective clothing. And so it's not a one-stop shop and not one solution for a lot of these issues. And so really counseling patients about how everything interplays into underlying skin disease.
In addition to creams like we were talking about and chemicals like hydroquinone, there are also some intravenous treatments that can have lightening effects that are being used in a lot of parts of Asia, but also are becoming common in some parts of the United States. Can you talk a bit about these treatments that may be used for hyperpigmentation but could also be misused for overall skin lightening?
Yes, absolutely. And so one example of this is intravenous glutathione treatments. And it's just so important for the viewers to know that the Food and Drug Administration has not approved any injectable drugs for skin whitening or skin lightening. And so the use of intravenous, meaning injecting through the veins, you know, for example, this glutathione, for off-label purposes of skin lightening is highly controversial and carries this considerable safety risk. And so this IV administration can seriously affect, you know, important organ systems like your neurologic system, kidney, liver organ systems, and sometimes can result in serious skin reactions.
So we know that there are risks to using these products in an off-label way, in an unrecommended way. We know there's an existence of products on the black market. So it kind of brings me to a solutions-oriented part of the conversation. And I wonder, Priya, for you, I mean, what did you hear from people about how to tackle this? There's obviously tackling the demand side and colorism and looking at why people perceive themselves in certain ways. And also the supply side, these companies that are profiting by selling these products to help people lighten their skin. Where do we go from here? What did you hear about that?
Yeah, it's a tough question because I would say that, you know, I think what we were hoping to see after what happened with George Floyd and then the Black Lives Matter movement was that, you know, that companies would pull out of this market. Of course, that's probably a very optimistic point of view because, again, like we said, this is also happening in the black market, but very few companies did that. You know, Fair and Lovely rebranded to Glow and Lovely. L'Oreal switched their terminology to feature the word glow as well. And only if I'm correct, P&G was the only company that cut and run because they said that their the profits were, you know, less than 1% of their total global sales. So this is like very much of a business proposition. So I don't think that the conglomerates are really going to be walking away. I think what then that goes on to, then how are they marketing this? What kind of educational tools are they giving to customers to say what this is and what this isn't? And I think on the customer side, it's really going to be them who's demanding the change. I think eventually, I mean, we might get to a point where it might be too toxic to sell these products as a company who claims to support Black Lives Matter, support purpose-driven initiatives. But right now, I think the power is in the customer's hand because, you know, they are voting every single day with their dollars. So how do you create a conversation that makes people that much more, you know, fervent and furious to get things to change?
Is there a conversation to be had, Dr. Ferguson, within the healthcare system about maybe cultural and racial sensitivity that could shape people's want or desire to use these products, do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's a great question. And I think this goes back to, you know, being able to have conversations with patients in a culturally competent manner. And I think also educating patients. So both, you know, when physicians and dermatologists are in the clinic talking to patients, but also kind of on a wider kind of public health, you know, educational initiative. And it is important to note that, you know, these medications like, you know, like hydroquinone are not necessarily benign medications. They can cause skin irritation and rashes, excessive skin lightening, and actually have paradoxical effects and cause darkening of the skin that can be more permanent and very difficult to get rid of. And really understanding that, you know, it's not just the hydroquinone, that a lot of these or some of these medications also can have added ingredients that can be very dangerous. So things like very high strength topical steroids that can lead to things like stretch marks and increased blood vessel growth and redness on the skin and skin thinning. And like, you know, we had mentioned a few times too, the very concerning that some of these products contain mercury that, you know, can affect your kidneys without knowing and injure your nerves, leading to things like numbness or tingling in hands, feet, and around your mouth. And, you know, having concern, especially for individuals with young children, how this could be passed on to children's skin and affect their growing brains. So it's important to have these conversations and educate our patients both in the clinic and in public-facing health campaigns as well.
I'm speaking with dermatological surgeon Dr. Ferguson, as well as Glossy executive editor Priya Rao, today on The State of Things. Just to close out the show, I mean, I'd love to hear from you both about your own personal reflections kind of through doing this work, and Priya, through doing this research. And maybe I'll start with you, Priya, of having the personal experience growing up and hearing these narratives from your mom that were different for each of you and your siblings based on your skin color, and now kind of growing up and doing this research. I mean, what do you walk away with in terms of how you want to change how you think about your own skin color or what you want to do moving forward if you were to have kids? Like how you would actively try to change this language even within the culture of your own home?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question because, you know, I think it took so long. I mean, I'm in my mid-30s now, and it's only now that I'm able to say these things out loud and out proudly. I think that's the conversation that so many of these families and cultures are having is because, you know, it's not talked about. It's not known that, you know, there's another option, that you can be, you know, have melanin-filled colored skin and be proud of it. And I think that's something that I'm only now realizing myself, even though I think of myself as an activist and I think of myself as someone who really appreciates inclusivity and diversity and representation, but how do you practice that in your own life? And I think when you talk about your own family, you know, what's interesting to me is that, you know, I'm in an interracial relationship. My husband's white. You know, he looks Irish. He's definitely much fairer than I am. And I think about, you know, when we have children, you know, what would I say to my daughter or son who would have darker or lighter skin, or who may maybe be made fun of because of their skin tone? And it's because I think it's important that we're having these conversations now so the next generation doesn't feel the oppressiveness of this kind of problem solution beauty industry where people aren't valued for who they are but what they look like.
Dr. Ferguson, any closing thoughts from you about navigating this beauty industry and this pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, changing the narrative and, you know, really building value and pride in individual skin color, I think is so important. And really changing the narrative, you know, from a dermatology perspective and how to maintain and keep healthy skin, I think is incredibly important. And, you know, for our specialty, I think, you know, just trying to, you know, kind of increase the diversity, the cultural competence, to really help, you know, kind of break down stereotypes, racial biases, challenge a substance, and broaden perspectives about racial, ethnic, and cultural differences, and really increase our awareness to provide the best care for our communities.
Dr. Kanyezi Ferguson is a dermatological surgeon and the director of the Ethnic Skin Care Clinic at University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Priya Rao is the executive editor of the fashion and beauty website Glossy and the host of Unfair, a podcast about the global skin lightening industry. Thanks so much for both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Anita.
You can find out more about our guests and the rest of the Embodied series at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also find a link there to the Embodied podcast. You can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts.